Welcome back to Offworld, the show where we talk about all things space exploration and pop culture. I'm Ariel Waldman.
And I'm Norm Chan. This week's episode is also a trope, not a specific film. It's a trope that's almost essential to the conceit of many science fiction films in which astronauts travel very far away, in which the systems, the computer systems they have are on the ships, have AIs on them.
Yeah, we're not talking about the AIs necessarily in robots with this episode. We're talking about the spaceship AIs. What happens when you have smart spaceships that are transporting humans around? Sometimes it gets pretty creepy.
And it's an idea that's been in science fiction for so long, even though the idea of AI and ship computers seems like a modern concept. We have this in HAL in 2001, made in the 60s, all the way to even the 80s. The Alien films had the mother spaceship where humans are directly communicating with a prompt, essentially.
Yeah, so we've got a couple of great guests today who are going to be talking about the AI aspects and where it shows up and kind of also the user interface aspects of interacting with a spaceship AI. So let's tune in. Today, I'm with Camille Eddy, a mechanical engineer with a focus on robotics and AI and a former participant in NASA's microgravity undergraduate research program, and Chris Nossel, the global design practice lead of travel and transportation at IBM and the author of scifiinterfaces.com. Thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, so we're talking about, you know, the trope of AI and specifically spaceship AI in science fiction, which comes up a lot. There's all these spacecrafts that are traveling the universe or they're landing on the moon or whatever, and they've got AI in them. What are some, you know, examples that you particularly like about, you know, spaceship AI or have really struck you as being kind of definitive examples of it?
Watching people in Star Trek on their user interfaces typing away saying, I'm creating an algorithm to help improve deflector shield something. I think that's really cool how they show the use of algorithms in science very fast and very quickly in those scenes.
It's pretty cool. I think I'd have to draw on like probably two. Of course, I work at IBM, I should talk about HAL. But HAL's problematic for some reasons.
Yeah.
I'm more fond of both The Heart of Gold from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, both for its incredibly annoying personality, which I think is illustrative of things we ought not to do. And I'm also super fond of the fact that the spaceships in Battlestar Galactica are themselves sentient. And that, to me, is like one of the most forward-looking things that we see in screen sci-fi, which trying to catch it up with literature sci-fi.
Yeah, for me, I think the things that are interesting to look at are how, you know, there's such a wide variety. So it's like you've got an alien, you've got Mother, who is kind of just a take on Alexa, more or less. You know, it can just go fetch things and do things, basic stuff. And then you've got, you know, all the way to, say, WALL-E, where it's really, you know, an embedded, controlling sort of AI in the spaceship. You know, we see in a lot of science fiction, especially older science fiction, AI that's essentially like the Alexas that we've got in our houses today.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what's out there that, you know, goes beyond that in science fiction that you've really enjoyed that, I guess, is still taking AI to that futuristic place even in 2018?
Watching, you know, the immediate translations of different languages, that was really interesting always to see, like, their feet, their mouths are moving, but they're hearing and understanding different languages.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and we're seeing that happen more and more even today, where they're coming up with these little translators in your pockets. So I think that's really interesting.
That's a cool one. The thing that always totally frustrated me, because they have lots of technologies in Star Trek to manage the translation, but I never understood how you could see their lips making the other language.
The English sound?
Like, that didn't make sense to me. Everything else made sense, but that. But still, yeah, that's super exciting. I think for me, there's a really exciting moment in Prometheus, where there's both an AI that's walking around the ship. Of course, that's David.
Yeah.
But he's interacting with the ship, managing the parts of space travel that humans really can't be bothered with in this case, because they're in sort of their hibernation mode, but also because there's stuff that's beyond our ken. But that, to me, starts to signal that sci-fi is beginning to illustrate how we're going to be handing different tasks to AI than we are to humans. And that's, I think, going to be pretty key to getting it right.
Yeah, I mean, one of the core things that you see in so much science fiction is voice-controlled AI, mm-hmm. like the main interface to AI is voice. Do you think that's, you know, I mean, I know you've analyzed this a lot with sci-fi interfaces, like is voice interaction, is it just tired or is there a good reason why everyone's using voice or, you know, are there other places to go that, that sci-fi should be considering?
I certainly think that voice has a lot of power. Right, we're able to represent things in our conversation now, everything from the super abstract down to minute details, like what a cool necklace you have on here. and it also, there's no, we don't have ear lids, so voice is available anywhere, anytime. I'm quoting McLuhan there, that's not my quote. So for that reason, voice has a lot of power, but it's incomplete. A lot of the stuff that we see in screen sci-fi are the beautiful visualizations that would be harder to convey through voice. If I was going to show you a flow diagram of where power is going from engines, you know, to life support or to shields or to weapons, it's much quicker to see a diagram and you know, see Scotty actually put more power to the deflector shields or to route out all the life support would be make much more sense in a visual way. And for that, I'm super happy that we live and watch sci-fi with the cool CGI and art direction that we've got today, because we can see a lot of those visualizations on screen. It don't always make sense on deep investigation, but this notion that it's going to be a combination of voice and some sophisticated information visualization, I'm on board for that.
I mean, so you've worked with actual astronauts before, and you've talked with them. Do you think voice, you know, when you're imagining what they've gone through, do you think voice is like a really easy way of interacting when you're, you know, in microgravity and floating around? Or have you heard of other ways in which astronauts like to interface with their technology on board the space station?
Yeah, I think, you know, voice could pose some problems, definitely, whether, you know, it's understood correctly or things like that. So I know that there's a lot of touch interfaces up in the International Space Station. And I think where we're going to see an improvement in technology is being able to get those user interfaces down to being very simple, and that they complete all the tasks they need to do and have some help along the way to say, hey, this is a task I'm going to be doing, and creating those streamlines, making them better. So I think that's the future.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So I'm in microgravity and I have a touchscreen interface.
Yes.
Don't I understand correctly that if I touch my selection, I'm going to be pushing myself away from that screen?
Yeah, for every like action, right? There's
right.
an opposite reaction.
Okay.
So you got to be careful.
You gotta be strapped in.
So I've seen like the bars on the side of the screen, but that means that you now have to think about the interface. Every astronaut is one-handed,
mm-hmm.
unless they're strapped
yeah.
in, right?
There's a lot of when they're coming up with new technology that they're going to use in space for the first time.
Yeah.
There's sometimes a requirement that says must have one-handed operation.
Okay.
So when I was in microgravity university, we had to design our tool to be able to have one-handed operation.
That makes sense.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, pretty cool. So actually talking about the International Space Station, I know they just recently have now Simon, which is some AI floating face mm-hmm. thing,
yeah.
like aboard. And it's the thing that really struck me about Simon was the fact that it was actually kind of built as a collaborative tool that it could help astronauts in problem solving and solving things. And this is something that I thought was interesting because a lot of times with AI, we talk about division of tasks and division of roles, and we assign them to do something so that we don't have to worry about it. But this is actually something where it's collaborative. You know, is collaborative AI something that's like present day being developed more and more as opposed to task-based AI?
Yeah, I think that fits right into like the NASA astronaut model and way of living because they're very collaborative anyway. So the idea that AI would just be on the ship running its own thing, doing its own processes, doesn't actually fit with their character. It would make sense that NASA would, or the space industry in general, would be interested in creating something that's more collaborative. So whether they're outside the space station working and it's helping them figure out what their next tasks are, or they're inside the International Space Station doing the same type of collaborative work, I think it's something that really fits into their character and their mode of living.
Yeah, and this was something that I think was a collaboration between like IBM Watson and the European Space Agency,
yes.
and
mm-hmm.
maybe DLR too. But mm-hmm. yeah, it's pretty cool.
And it's similar to like the spheres, which that we've been seeing go around the space station. So think of that, but shiny, white, and really pretty.
So talking about other things that sort of pop up on spaceships, you know, you mentioned liking Star Trek a lot. Like there's the emergency medical hologram. Mm-hmm. And so that's another version of AI that I thought was interesting and that we see a lot of, you know, is sort of the way forward that would be working best with humans, maybe not AI as a collection of, you know, algorithms. And then there's sort of this anonymous personality behind it, but AI is sort of an uploaded human personality based on an actual human and within a singular sort of organism, so to mm-hmm. speak. Mm-hmm. You know, is that something, Chris, that like you think is a way forward that might be more, I guess, palatable for humans, like when they're working with AIs, that instead of having like the HAL that is, you know, just this center creature, so to speak, that is hard to sort of wrap your head around, that you've got instead like a human being who's been uploaded right. to be an AI?
I think there are two questions under that question.
Okay, sure, yeah.
There's one, which is neuroreplication the right way to get to general AI?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a computer scientist, even though I work at IBM. And I think that's problematic, and I don't think that's where the science is going, because humans are a weird crapshoot of genetics and education and the birth, you know, where were they born, how much money did their parents, all those sorts of complicated questions that result in humans. And so the is neuroreplication the right way? Certainly sci-fi likes to think so. I doubt it, just as an amateur. The second question is, do we find interacting with personalities easier than interacting with, like, you know,
a
deadpan, dispassion? I like to think that Spock was training us to work with something that's in between,
mm-hmm.
Because I think if we trained our AI to feel like it had personalities, it would raise in us expectations that AI is not going to be able to meet until we get to that general AI. So I mentioned The Heart of Gold, and Eddie's super positive and happy, and of course the other character in that same show is Marvin. Marvin's very depressed and sad, and that's part of the joke. And I think those are both jokes because they're illustrations of how we can go too far with that sort of thing. For my money, a little personality is enough.
Yeah. Any thoughts on, you know, I guess personally, as you know, you've done a lot of work like looking into the ethics of AI and interactions. You know, do you think maybe there are different ethical considerations about like interacting with an AI that's based off of a human being versus an AI that's kind of a mashup of, you know, hundreds of human beings?
Yeah, I think there's certainly some pitfalls that we'll probably look at. Like, you know, there's an idea that if you know that it's AI, will you treat it differently, or will you respond to it, or you know, follow its directions differently than you would a normal human being? And so we have to also look at training and coming up to awareness of how we're going to actually be interacting with this, and maybe design it ahead of time versus waiting for it to get there and then bring it to the rest of society and then see what happens. I think this is something that's going to need training because it's really different from what we've been doing before. And even if you watch Star Trek and look at the interactions with the emergency medical hologram, you can see that there was some vying there about whether it was human, whether mm-hmm. how much respect you have for it. And while they might not be sentient, we do want to probably think about it because it can have some long-term effects on how it's used and how it affects society in general. And I think it's better if we plan ahead versus wait for it to get here.
Yeah, I mean, talking about that long duration stuff, you know, in some stuff we see AI as being sort of the onboard psychologist for like long duration missions. And yeah, I'm curious your thoughts on if that's actually a useful thing, because, you know, being a psychologist, even if you're professionally trained, there's a cognitive load to that as a human being. And if maybe AI is something that can either alleviate that, or if AI might be something that causes more problems, I guess, when thinking about those longer, you know, imagine you're like out on a spaceship, you know, isolated for many years and decades, you know. Yeah, I mean,
Eliza worked, right? Do you guys remember Eliza? She was a Rogerian psychologist that was coded in the 1960s, and you would type something into like an MS-DOS prompt, and it would look for keywords, and then ask you questions back. Like, so you'd say, "Oh, I'm having a terrible day." Oh, what makes you say you're having a terrible day? And one of the most famous stories about Eliza as a program was that the secretary, the fellow who programmed it, actually knowing that it was just a program, actually asked for some alone time with Eliza because she wanted to work through some things, right? Like, it's useful even when we know it's a placebo. There's a great, Barbarella is a film from the late 1960s.
Yep.
And she hasn't, most people think about the costumes in that film, yes, and how silly it is, but she has an AI on board that spaceship and his name is Alfie. And he's got this really cool op art display. But when you take a look at the functions that Alfie has in the ship, it's just social. He is her Eliza, just there to have somebody as a companion on these long travels through, you know, dramatic space. So I would lean, if that's any indication, that the answer is yes. We're going to need them for their social utility as well.
Yeah, I mean, something that I think this brings up is if we should be embedding worry into AI or not. So a few examples are, for instance, in Alien Covenant that I just watched recently, you know, the ship is trying to go into the atmosphere and the ship just very basically is saying, I can't let you do that. The ship's going to break apart. Mm-hmm. And they're like, override. And the ship's like, no, I really can't let you do that. The ship is going to break apart. And they're like, override anyway. So that's like a very basic level. But in, for instance, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, there's a scene where Arthur is asking for a cup of tea and the spaceship says, oh, I've analyzed your emotions and everything about you and I've developed the perfect drink that you want. Here it is. And he's like, I don't want this. I just want tea. And so the spaceship is going like, why would he want tea? Why doesn't he want what I would want to give him? And is so perplexed about this that it's unable to like deal with like a missile attack at the same time because it's worrying about why is the human not going for it? And then what else? Oh, like in Moon. So the space structure on the moon is very concerned about its human occupants because it's been designed to.
Yeah.
But we kind of see then AI getting, I guess, a bit complicated because of that. And it's worrying so much about humans that it either can't accomplish other tasks or it's kind of overstepping its bounds because it takes this one thing about worrying with humans. And so I guess the question is sort of like, especially when it comes to space and you're dealing with humans who are isolated, you know, should AIs be worrying about humans or should we leave worrying about humans to other humans? I guess this is kind of an ethical question. I know it's kind of large.
No. Yeah, I think worry is one of those things that make us also unpredictable. So I personally, if I was living in a spaceship, I don't know if I want to be near an unpredictable AI. But I do think it's interesting to look at AI as far as, you know, being able to understand different things. Like we're already using chatbots, you know, that are using predictive algorithms. So what does that look like? And seeing how you can create a more comprehensive lifestyle with the collaborative AI. So it's collaborative not just in the sense of International Space Station, right? It's collaborative in the sense of living your everyday life with AI.
Yeah. I mean, we see, you know, sometimes the worry go haywire. So we have like rogue AI, like in 2001, most like, you know. So what are your thoughts about that? Like, is it something where, you know, embedding all of this worry and having AIs be so incredibly powerful, is rogue AIs kind of going to inherently be an output of asking them to do so much and worry about us so much?
There is a fundamental question that we have to answer culturally, like species-wide, as what we do with AI. Because we could say it, and the GDPR kind of hints at, we should keep it to where it is understandable and not predictable, but at least transparent.
Mm-hmm.
And if we use AI that way, we will never solve problems that humans could not themselves have solved. If we want to use AI to solve new problems that humans have wrestled with for, you know, how many thousands of years can we claim credit for being civilized? then we have to let it go a little bit. Maybe even past, like, even with deep neural networks, it has to go back to where, beyond where we can kind of trace it and even explain what it's doing, where it is. And unfortunately, the trade-off is that it's sometimes going to make decisions or recommendations, and it's not going to be able to explain in ways that people get. There's a great piece of sci-fi that's largely forgotten called Dark Star. It was one of James Cameron's very early films in which the ship has a super dumb AI, and this society has decided that it's going to use all of its smart AI on the bombs. So the bombs are super smart, and they have the, I know, right, terrifying.
Yeah, terrifying.
They have the AI, and there's this rogue bomb that has, there's a glitch on the ship because it's decaying, and the bomb has said, oh, I'm gonna explode, but it's not letting go of the ship. So they have to kind of talk it down and convince it why it shouldn't do the thing that it was made for, what it was living for. And it eventually like drifts right into philosophy, and it's a dark, horrible ending. See the film, it's weird, it's B, it's James Cameron's early work, but it certainly touches on this risk that if we want to use AI to get us past the great filter that we're probably faced with right now, then we run this terrible risk. But if we don't, we're not going to utilize it for the power that it promises. Mm. Big, long answer.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a really big problem for all of us, because we tend to not necessarily like being in a nebulous situation where we don't know where the answer is or what the question is, kind of like in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, right, 42. what was the question? So I think that's something that we need to prepare ourselves if we do let it go. Are we as a society going to be okay with something that doesn't necessarily have an answer or a question to it? And then how do we survive with ourselves, or, you know, how do we do that?
Yeah, and I think it's all like super relevant to space exploration, because inherently we are exploring, we're going into new territories, and we're mm-hmm. wanting to bring along tools with us that might be a bit smarter than us about identifying stuff, but it brings about like a lot more unknown. So mm-hmm. it's really fascinating. So I guess my final question for both of you is, what sort of AI do you not see represented enough in space-related science fiction and films and movies, or what sort of AI would you like to see, or scenarios even? Chris?
Two come to mind. The first is that just owing to the nature of science fiction, when we encounter other species, they're quite human-like. And I suspect that is unlikely to be real. And for humans to be able to comprehend other life, we're going to have to look for something that's not human. And I think AI will be able to do that much better than we will. So one scenario I'd love to see is where humans are encountering life that doesn't look like any kind of life that we think of, and yet the AI helps to see it, acts as that translator. That scenario I haven't seen a lot of, and boy, it's probably the most likely one. If we find life rather than the long forgotten AI that's left behind when a culture destroys itself.
Right.
So that's one. The second one is that there are two metaphors in science fiction AI. One I call the Stoic Guru, which is where the AI knows everything, but it only responds to questions, right? In Star Trek, the original series, the computer knew about time travel, but it didn't bother to tell anybody until Kirk asked it. Like, that's just crazy. There's another model, which is becoming a little bit more common now, that I call the Active Academy, where the AI is working on something, and it's giving you the best answer that it's got, but as new information comes in, it may occasionally say, wait a minute, we've got another answer for you. And I can't think of a single example where the spaceship AI interrupts the characters to say, I've got some news, or we need to change plans because I've got some news. And that moment, I think, is going to be half of how we work with AI. Yes, we're going to ask it questions, but it's going to be turning around and asking us some too.
I like that. It's going to ask us questions. Yeah. That's cool. For me, you know, when we watch these shows, sometimes we get there and it's like after the fact. Like, oh, it's 20,400, and we're after the fact that we've already created all this. So I would like to see AI more in progress.
Ooh, yeah.
So like, what does it look like as you're discovering it? How does it lead to the next discovery? So for example, I mentioned user interfaces back at the beginning. I want to see how we start using AI to make it so that we're doing less like on the keyboard, up here on the screen. Like, that's my real interest of how we're going to create better interfaces, better ways to communicate, better ways to have ships, build ships. How are we going to do that? And then I want to see how the AI gets to that point, because I don't think we're there yet.
And the mistakes we make
and
on
the
way.
Yes.
Yes.
It could be like something that's along our today's timeline. I think we need more stories about today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you both so much for being on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So talking about AI and space exploration is incredibly important, because as we're going further and further into space with humans, we are having to figure out how AI is going to work best for all of us. If you really enjoy geeking out about all this sort of thing and sci-fi interfaces, check out Chris's book called Make It So. He also has a new book called Designing Agentive Technology, AI That Works for People. Thanks so much for tuning in. Remember to subscribe on YouTube, and I'll see you next time.